This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My next guest is Gillian Connolly, a San Francisco Bay Area poet who is also a professor and poet in residence at Sonoma State University, where this program is coming from. And she's also the founding editor of the literary journal Vault. Connolly is the author of over half a dozen collections, including Some Gangster Pain, Lovers in the Used World, The Plot Genie, and others, all great titles. Her honors include 4 Pushcart Prize publications, a Fund for Poetry Award, the Academy of American Poets Award, a fellowship from the Washington State Arts Commission, residency at the McDowell Colony, and a grant from the Northwest Institute for Advanced Study. Welcome, Gillian.
Thank you.
Well, even though we both spend a lot of time in Sonoma County, California, we actually met at Vermont College when I was getting my MFA there. You were co-leading a workshop with Ralph Angel.
Mm-hmm.
That was a while back.
That was a while back. I don't remember. I mean, how many years was that?
I don't want to know.
Okay. So, but I remember it well.
You've been in California for a long time now, but you're originally a Texas girl.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you grow up, and what was it like for you as a budding poet in Texas?
Okay. I grew up in Taylor, Texas, which is about 36 miles northeast of Austin, and it's a small town of 10,000 people. And growing up there was terrific in ways that you would not expect. It was when I was growing up, it was a very vibrant, functioning town, a real community, not a suburb. It's not a suburb now, but now it's just this sort of blown up, decimated place, another casualty of Walmart, you know.
Yeah.
But the town itself, when I was growing up, was what was interesting, and I think what fed into my writing were many things, one of which was my father grew up there as well. Because of that, I knew stories about generations of people, and it was a very knowable place. You know, both in terms of its topography. I walked every inch of that town. There was nothing else to do. But I also knew so much about all the inhabitants of the town, mm-hmm. and knew lots of stories and lots of lore about different families, you know, true or not. And they would take on these kind of fantastic elements because people told stories a lot, you know, to entertain mm-hmm. themselves. And because there was so much cultural deprivation, people had to entertain themselves in ways that, you know, are kind of lost in our culture now. So, and the other thing that I think was really intriguing about growing up there was that on the streets at any particular time, you could hear several different languages. You could hear,
oh my.
Yeah, you could hear, you know, English, of course, but you could hear German, Czech, Polish, Spanish. There was a large Mexican American population, and there were a lot of people in Central Texas that had immigrated from Eastern Europe, from Czechoslovakia. Oh. That's where barbecue comes from. People.
The Spanish isn't surprising, but the other languages are to me. That's mm-hmm. those are all the languages you expect to hear in a city when you're growing
mm-hmm.
up. But I wouldn't imagine Texas.
Yeah. Well, I don't think. I don't think that would be currently true in the town. A lot of my friends' parents were, you know, first generation immigrants coming in from, and they spoke English with heavy, especially Czech accents, mm-hmm. and would speak in Czech frequently. So the just having those sounds around mm-hmm. was unusual. I didn't know it was unusual at the time in, you know, small town America,
yeah.
but it was it made it a rich you know, in terms of the sounds that you heard, that was a rich thing.
You were going to say something about barbecue, where
barbecue
came from.
Oh, yeah, that the barbecue comes from that exact thing, from Eastern European people coming to Central Texas, and because they were, you know, German, Polish, the sausages, the all of that, and then being smoked, and that's where barbecue.
Interesting.
Yeah, people don't know that.
No, you think of it, it came from the South somewhere, but not from another country.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I heard somewhere that your parents owned and operated a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
What was that?
That was KTAE Radio, which is defunct at the moment. And the radio station was, the town had two streets running through it, a main street and second street, and that was it. And the radio station was downtown. It was only an AM station, and you know, very small, but a lot of people, my dad started it right after World War II with, I think there were three other men and himself. And my mother worked at the station, too. She did all the accounting and business stuff. And what was great was it was the time in our country when a lot of musicians traveled through these towns, and they would come to the radio stations, and there would be a recording studio, and they would play to push their music.
Yeah.
You see examples of this in... the movie that it's the Johnny Cash movie where Joaquin Phoenix plays Johnny Cash. I'm not remembering the name of it.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Anyway,
they had Elvis Presley was there, Johnny Cash, Wilson Pickett, James Brown.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so all these people came through. I wasn't born yet when Elvis came, but I was very young. When, you know, people like James Brown or Wilson Pickett or those people came through, I do have real clear memories of Joe Tex, who the song Skinny Girls, Skinny Legs and All, that was the name of the song that he did. But my sister, who is 4 years older, has clearer memories of the different people coming through. But there was one disc jockey who loved soul music and was African American, and he had grown up in a small town. He didn't grow up in Tyler, but he grew up in a town similar to it. And he was working as a disc jockey in Dallas. And this was right when hardcore soul music started to go pop, like when the Supremes started to sound more popish, and he wanted to continue to play mainstream soul. Real soul music, and he realized he couldn't do it in Dallas anymore because they were going pop. So he came back and found my dad's station and moved there, and he had a huge following. Like, everyone in Austin listened to him, he was just terrific. So soul music was one of the things that was played. And then Mexican-American polkas, country western, of course. And then there was just a lot, you know, news programs where if somebody's cow got loose, you could call the radio station and they would put, you know, on Farm Market Road 28 today, there's a cow.
Interrupt James Brown to announce.
Yeah. So there was a real sense of community. And
Wonderful was, memories.
Mm-hmm.
So did the music that you heard on your parents' station influence you as well as, you know, just hearing all the stories around town?
Definitely. And especially in my early work in, I think, some gangster pain, and there are the rhythms of country music and the narratives are present. And I would still say, I think in the book that I just completed, I think in that book, that book is called Peace, P-E-A-C-E, Peace, which is an audacious title, but everyone who's read the book says that's the title of the book, so I'm going with it. There are some of the rhythms are definitely, and go back to that time period. And so I think mm-hmm. there's that kind of, I don't know, Americana kind of sound that might still be present.
Your roots.
Yeah, right? that are still there. Because in that book, one of the concerns is the notion of, you know, if we are going to have war the rest of our lives, which it certainly looks like that's mm-hmm. going to be the case, how does one experience peace at the same time as war? Is mm-hmm. that possible? And how does one do that concurrently? So I was thinking a lot about, I think I was, you know, we're under the illusion, people of my generation, that we did know peace in our country mm-hmm. growing up, but of course we didn't. Right. We were always at war. So anyway, there's memories of coming of age in the Vietnam War, and my father was a Marine who fought in World War II, and there's some of that echoing in the new book.
And that book is coming out next year from Omnidon, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to ask you to read some poems from that book, but okay. First I'm going to ask you to turn your attention to an earlier book, The Plot Genie.
Okay.
Where did the title come from?
The title came from a plot-generating device that was created by a writer named Wycliffe A. Hill in the 1930s. He actually started working on it in, I think, 1916. And it was used a lot in Hollywood, apparently. And from what I've read, it was used by you know, quote-unquote serious writers and hack writers alike, to generate plots. And it was essentially, it's a game of chance. You know, it's this very elaborate, obsessive system that he created where there were many volumes. There was like romance, adventure, romance without melodrama, which is, I love that title, comedy.
Is there such a thing?
And, something else, detective, mystery. And what you were supposed to do was dial up, you know, 9 different numbers, and that would make your plot, and then you could dial up. There were all these indexes, and you mm-hmm. dialed up. You were given a little card, which is actually on the cover of the book, my book, The Plot Genie, that you dialed the number, and then you went to the different books, and you got... you know, you were given whatever you were asking for, whether it be plot or character or setting or whatever, and then you went with it. And he was very, Wycliffe A. Hill was very particular in his own instructions as to keep it a game of chance. Mm-hmm. So I was intrigued by it when it came into the, I didn't seek it out. My husband, who's a crime writer, ordered it, and it came into the house, and we were both real excited before it was going to come because we knew what, you know, we figured out what it was. And I was real intrigued by it because I started imagining the characters that were trapped inside the system of mm-hmm. it and were inherently already there mm-hmm. and couldn't get out. And so for my book, it became a metaphor for just being alive in our culture now, where we seem sort of addicted to narratives, to stories, to mm-hmm. You know, events happening on and on, but without any real conclusion or, you know, oftentimes meaning, or, you know, we just seem to sort of spin on them.
Right. So, we hear a news story and it's horrible and then it's gone.
Is
it still happening?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We don't have a master narrative anymore. We have a million little blip narratives that mm-hmm. Just kind of bloom and blossom into one another. And so anyway, it seemed, that's the way I thought about it. And I was also just enchanted by the apparatus.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And how many different writers had used it. Like, one of the things that's fun is that when it would come with, you know, little red pencil marks and mm-hmm. if somebody had used it. And one volume that we got, there was a plot that somebody had dialed up. And it was just, that it was this useful device was what was interesting to me about it.
I've heard your work described at different times as language poetry, experimental, multidimensional. How would you describe what you do in poetry? And you can talk about that for as long as you want.
Okay. What was the last word you used there?
Multidimensional.
I like that. Multidimensional. That sounds good. I'm not a language poet. I think that term gets thrown around so much, and I wish people would become more cognizant of what that was a particular movement that happened on the East Coast and the West Coast in the 70s and early 80s. There are at least three different books that describe the movement really well. Mm-hmm. One is by Charles Bernstein. Anyway, if people can find those, if you really want to delve into language poetry and understand what it is, we certainly don't have time to go into what it is here because
no.
It would take a very long time. But
That's a class.
I think the one thing that language poetry did for poetry is it made us realize that language is material, it's stuff, mm-hmm. you know. And so that might be why some people would, because when I write, I recognize that language is material, and I'm very aware of that. Yet at the same time, I think my work is really grounded, and I am interested in meaning and how it floats through language.
And sound. You use white space in really interesting mm-hmm. ways in your work.
I'm very interested in the page mm-hmm. as not a neutral force, but almost like a canvas or a musical score, that it is as important as the language that appears on it and the sounds, and it's just this very integrated thing that is there. And in my really early work, I thought of the page as being completely neutral. Mm-hmm. And then I think the longer one is an artist of any sort, one becomes more aware of the materials that you are using and starts to feel, I don't know, enriched by them or understand them in some new way.
Right.
And that kind of thing started to happen.
Yeah, hopefully we keep learning from those materials that we're using. And
yeah.
In this case,
yeah.
It's language.
And I also think, you know, to go back to what we were talking about earlier with there being so many different languages in the town I grew up in and hearing this, mm-hmm. that I loved language from the very beginning,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
as a material, and because I didn't, you know, I was hearing German, I was hearing Czech, but I didn't know what it meant, and so the language became something that wasn't necessarily communicating in this very direct way. It was sound, and it was a thing, and it was procreant, and it was changing, and it was its own medium, its own system. And I still think of language as that way, but I'm also really—I don't want just a bunch of language thrown on a page. It's not, you know, it's not interesting to me. My poems do make sense. A kind of sense.
Yes, they do.
So,
well, let's turn
okay.
from them now.
All right.
I'll ask you to start off by reading from The Plot Genie,
okay.
which is in print right now,
mm-hmm.
and then you can move on to Peace, which is coming out next year.
That sounds great. Okay, thank you. All right. Now, I'm going to read the first poem that's in The Plot Genie, And one thing that you might notice is the syntax of you know, if this happens or to do this, which is a syntactical move that is in the actual apparatus of the plot generating device. And so I adopted that in this poem that begins the book. Okay, the plot genie. If a person is fawning or obsequious to another, to remove a taboo, to be rid of carping, the desire to obtain possession of a key, insanely jealous love. We are here to escape payment of a lost wager, to secure life insurance, to escape an abomination. Evening, white sand, a small distant figure, tiny sultan, or a speck on the windshield stirring. A natural reality of white summer, of white panes. Once a handsome dead man was floating on the pool. White sand, small distant figure came into view, and you felt a pang of delight under your skull as we drove on, speck on the windshield stirring in white summer of white panes. Then hum to read night's starry dismemberment of book, Hamlet's toque feather drifting down Mallarmé's page, and come morning we were going up to Portland, backing out the car. It was day. A moose was sighted in the forest. A bus decayed in its interior. The palace gate swung shut. Low, evaporating trails of night terror of what happening. The getting there of next. Let me introduce Miss Jane Sloan, head of the department, and a very capable authoress, dozing off in an armchair near the window, near nature producing its unidentical designs, the chasm side of a stick of butter. The plot genie is baking a pan of biscuits. The plot genie is one of the most virile helps which has ever been devised. Someone is falling into an ancient cave comfort, barely touching another origin, dialing a unique number and none other, holding the plot genie in the hollow of an arm while careful not to bend, spinning while out the gates trots a horse color of gray, dark splotch. Soon we are approaching the studios to say, was it better than a painting, to get even with someone, to use a colloquialism, in the light of a game or a sporting event? In the house of shadows, the shadow of the house. In the house I hear nothing but laughter, weaponry, airy plumes on helmets, war relics, and attic wasps. In the dusty corners, parasitical words, having drunk of an antiquity by whose forces Europe ruled. The house resting blankly in wintry afternoon, curing in the sun like a little ham. The plot genie's hand reflected in the lake, her hand smudged in the flat, calm glare. In a bunkhouse, underworld dope den, back of a music hall, in a bachelor's apartment. Betty, then Veronica, meticulously dressed in the margins. Archie never drawn too quickly, but with patience, exactitude, and the white rapids he might one day shave from his face, always speaking in the simple human tongues that Sappho kept going, admiring their clarity. To be free and 21, to be born into a lush landscape and to come back to it in a box, as if in an old evening suit. The genie tells you what happens, and you listen, as if in repay for the years the swarming locust has eaten. The genie tells you what happens, and then along come still others to explain. If you still don't get it, the plot genie repeats. Okay, so that's the end of that particular section, and it goes on that most of the characters of the plot genie are introduced there. Handsome dead man, there's E and R who are lovers and write love poems back and forth to each other, and there's Comedy Boy who's kind of a Hermes, he's the messenger between them. And there's Miss Jane Sloan. Maybe I'll read one more from Miss Jane Sloan. Okay. This comes right after that. This is a prose poem. As a child, Miss Jane Sloan came upon a diamondback rattler. On a Girl Scout day camp, s'mores and wieners, old gray sheds, blisters and sunburn, at least one case of bull nettle rash on a bare ass. Motes drifting above weedy path like automata surveying an earlier globe. The diamondback did not rattle. In hot noon sun, pungent sulfur smell of snake, the child body of Miss Jane Sloan alarmingly tangible as she walked backward. Nervous spasms beneath her white socks. High grass parting like disinterested third person standing aside to let her pass. To let her back so far away, just far enough away so she could still see. Where, look, there is a wooden bench just strong enough for her to stand on. It was a beautiful sunny day. A peculiar speech signal could be overheard between suspects. I was afraid I was about to permit an unrecognized sister to starve. A relative had decided to jump a bail bond. Part of a body, or a portion of the spoils, was found in the possession of the subject. And Miss Jane Sloan went down. She went down the white road of aftermaths. No Titanic. She went down the alterations of, to the barely beyond, where everything was begging everything to come back to where we live. When Miss Jane Sloan closed her eyes, she could feel slight neuronal embraces caving in, tuned to the vibration of other tormentresses. Whatever sulks there, the dust eliminated. Destiny is a world apart. And I'll just keep on with one more. To remove a taboo, to be rid of carping, is the desire to obtain possession of a key. The desire to bring about a reformation, to overthrow authority, is to satisfy an appetite. The screen is the desire to produce a phenomenon. How much everyone needed a glass of water. We are here to escape payment of a lost wager, to secure life insurance, to satisfy a horoscope, to defeat a plot, the river's sheen, to possess an abode, our virgin torso, to be refused forgiveness, to escape from a master, to get relief from a monstrosity or abomination. A line of boxcars slides open, completely frontal, to escape a carousel.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. My guest tonight is Gillian Connolly. She is a poet and professor at Sonoma State University. She's been reading from one of her several books, The Plot Genie, and in just a minute we'll move on to her latest collection, Peace, which is coming out from Omnidon in 2014. Let's return now to Gillian Connolly reading from The Plot Genie.
This poem is called I Am the Girl with One Glass Eye, Said Bitterly. My name is the girl with one glass eye, said bitterly. Nightingale in the bird feeder hung from the pepper tree, opening throat to the body of light in. Was it spring? Spring shipwreck. High voices, lank hounds ramping it up over a highway, arcing out into empty air. Where we were resiliencies at the edges of time, dining on upended peach crates, on lawn chairs dropped into the shaded pool of the bottomless, where through the murk muses and mediums regenerate the pool's Elysian scum. I am the girl who opens the seashell that stirs the cauldron that sings us back to the leafy path which worn and cobbled through. What do you walk upon? Something already in the blood. What line of work you in? Job is Job, is Job, is Job, is Job. It's all part of an infinite series, foci, aperture, two-thirds, three-fourths, one-eighth, scherzo, pattern, I get it. You look like someone I used to know, drinking out of a garden hose. Can we summon by the hooks in the water all the broken, as in the belly of an unsuspecting mother? Can we open the hatchback to hear the Gothic echoes? A virgin forest asway amid the giant sperm? Tomb for tit, cum, wounds, extension cords carried to a midnight execution and left to dangle there. A beheadedness played over and over, culture soaking it up. I knew a garden. Meaning of the world is the intaglio of It's Sunny in 75. What do you walk upon? Something already in the blood drafts and ink, reconstitutes the flowers. Do you feel a light in the sun on your back, piercing through the water? It's a light, said the I am the girl with one glass eye, said bitterly. Now let me go, she said, holding the flowers to long opal tails of moon, waving slowly from time to time, saying, no, 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 no. I am the girl, now that we are in the page of infinite length, in the city of uplanded height, on the lawn of rising green, in the alley tunneled down to a chambered core. And I said, how many people did you see on the road, rolling up their old kit bag? How many people did you see, trying to get where, trying to get there, trying to see the many people you have seen on the road, under the stars' starkness, under the exits entranced, under the mistral of rain, feeding the lengthening stream we step into, out of, shuddering, pictured there. Okay. So now we will whiplash into a completely other world. My new book, which I talked a little bit about, it's called Peace. And I think I'll read a couple of poems from there. This poem is called Opened, and it is from Gabrielle. It's dedicated to Gabrielle Giffords, who was the U.S. representative who was shot, and among many others, in the open meeting in the Safeway parking lot in Tucson on January 8th, 2011. And the poem uses phrases from President Obama's memorial speech, which was delivered after the shooting. And it also uses phrases that were repeated on news radio following Japan's March 11th, 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and meltdown of three nuclear reactors. What happened is I was writing the poem and I was driving a lot, which I tend to do anyway, and listening to radio, which is where I get everything. And so the phrasing of the news came into the poem. I remember at the time I wrote the poem, Diane Sawyer was telling us a lot on television media that she was going to be okay, she was going to run again, everything was just fine. But the media would not show her to us, and she was really secluded. And of course, we didn't know at the time that she could only. I don't think she was even wasn't even speaking at that point, you know. And as we know now, words are still coming very difficultly for her. Anyway, it's for Gabrielle Giffords, and it's called Opened. So it was like sleep and waking, sleep and fraud on my visa. Sleep, California waiting out radioactive plume, and today another trying card in Miami Winn-Dixie. Did they want groceries or did they want cash? Sleep. Freeway sign said take lucky drive to bypass bank robbery and shopping mall. So that's where the two bullets went through. What sphinx pushes up out the fog in the parking lot, turning each upon each our moral imaginations. If it's a gun law, this tragedy will pull through. And what was there to, and did she see, gritty blue sink of desert night sky, with her off to the side like a wonder, or your basic hospital room, sleep, a solitary male nurse, a husband. Here we pour a new layer, visible for all to see how we want to be as transparent as possible, but remain gradient, dangerous when once it was them. An error, a horror now that it is. What are we to the man who attacked the gunman as he started to reload? A constituency? Ducks in the arcade stir a glassy water, sleep, amplify. Gun with cord tied to it so no one will take it. The little girl with a hole in her chest, first girl player to play in the middle leagues. Gritty blue sunken, shame, as if the desert could hiss, fold, the six dead behind her eyelids. Leave them open. Let us place no more constraints on the eyes of the dead. Illegible crossouts turned inward, searching themselves to escape like figures met in a dream. She is walking down the hall with a shopping cart. Never and always a back to the door, whose side? Once she appears again, but they won't show her to us at her husband's launch of four spacewalks to install the alpha magnetic spectrometer it will take all four walks to sift, sleep through cosmic rays to define the origin of the universe, though by now that plays a minor key. It could be plutonium. It could be uranium. We just don't know. A radioactive plume to drift over California Friday by noon, a shadow of cloud on the stream, crows that range and radiate from cloud to tumbling cloud. And what will she say privately? And what will she say in that language of our conviction? This tragedy will pull through, and we'll stand by you tomorrow. It isn't really heavily radiated water. How one eye keeps one eye on a deep and bitter thing. And I'll this is just the next poem that shows up in the manuscripts. It's called Late Democracy. We, the undersigned, understand then the green of the meadow has turned to you who are not my body. I vow to you my resemblance, unequal in value and significance to string my verbal chain. Just let me go out swilling whiskey in the hill country as imagined and planned. Who wants to sit around worrying about third-party ads on the site where she and he who is one of them, sweet secret green of the yellow, troll? They are going to steal my identity, metaphysic of a clicking bloom, lotus cup. Okay, and now I would like to read a poem. I can read this. This poem is, the title of it is A Hatchet with Which to Chop at the Frozen Seas Inside Us, which is Kafka. A hatchet with which to chop at the frozen seas inside us. To wake to winter in the coming out of the time of year when they release the masterpieces, but to be still in the other night. Some drown in movies. Some prefer the unfinished, ungovernable recital, a mystical ecology where one dies in a camp or rolls out with the dice on the sidewalk among boys with cardboard shields and plays dead in white crinoline. What if paradise was only lifting the veil to flirt? No one perfect, but perfection inserts us so. Pascal thinks a god in his pocket. What if paradise meant walking on the ground of our self-estrangement, and the veil of our gaze, an unsteady balm, was not what we saw through, but were, twisting, untwisting? Do you believe we were never strictly servants? Okay, and now I will read, this is a longer poem. I got it in my head that I wanted to write a poem about Gandhi because, you know, this book meditates so much on the whole notion of peace. And so I started to think about Gandhi a lot. So I did a lot of research on Gandhi and found out things that I didn't know about Gandhi that were problematic. And then I thought, oh my God, I can't write a poem about Gandhi. And then I thought, no, I'll write a poem called trying to write a poem about Gandhi. So that's what I did. Trying to write a poem about Gandhi. One, the future leaves roses on the bed for the long stretch of the waker at the window left to pull the day around. History props up and swarms a lot of time. Wonder will he walk back? Should we still run to keep up with him? Fingers quick to thread the spinning wheel. A dizziness in the face of a social machine. Silver infinitesimal motes shine, lift, and hover cloud. I shake out the dryer's lint drawer into garage air. Satyagraha. No power over the soul. The body suffers. There's some Sanskrit in the poem. Two. A silver pocket watch pinned to a loincloth. Better to hand wash in past and in future. Postmodernism's gone all artisan. Motes swirling up into stale garage door. Open door to let it drift out, spread into wisteria's tresses. Ahimsa, a matter not of the intellect, but of the heart. Three. Beloved figures die to stop and loop to pixelate. A history sweeps and fells the picture field. In uppermost loamy branches of the giant oak sit Thoreau, Tolstoy, Ruskin, Emerson, and Carlyle, shining down their texts. Unorthodox social moralists of the 19th century still trying to freeze hell. Many leafy, wandering past participles in my neighborhood alone. Also one assault rifle, a shotgun, two Glock pistols, one tactical armored vest. How do I know this? Several gas masks, one child's ballistic leggings, ballistic helmet, one known pedophile. Best to try not to wish anyone dead. Think John Berryman, quote, I woke up and I had not murdered anyone, unquote. Before I turned back to the dryer, thinking, why think or try to be like Marx, who said at the end of his life, I am not a Marxist. That's my girl's lost blue sweater hung on the fence post. Best to think of even nuisances in your inbox as pilgrims on earth, immortal spirits on probation. Four. How to make of one's garden a Tolstoy farm and be chief magistrate, prime minister, main teacher, chief baker, chief sanitary inspector of a modest magnetic field produced by electric currents in Earth's outer core, on Earth's crust, primarily quartz, silicon dioxide, and other silicates like feldspar. One too bright day, here comes Manu and Abha. Manu, grandniece, and Abha, wife of grandnephew, Gandhi's girls and walking sticks, his hands on their shoulders as he walked everywhere with them toward the end. Poverty easy, but chastity eludes and means funny sleeping arrangements. Younger and younger naked girls to sleep beside to maintain chastity. Brahmacharya, elimination of all desire in the face of temptation. Accept the body, you pussy, Picturefield says, dropping down. Great thinkers are scheming demotic despots. It's a thin line to undo and silly to be an apologist for a pacifist. Dale Carnegie, check. Madame Blavatsky, check. Why think God doesn't like pussies, cocks, girls, Gandhis all together? Well, you'd have to ask the girls. And later, it's a sub-rosa geological planet with shifting hot mantles of tectonics. Someone should tell Einstein, even though it's too late, who said, future generations will hardly grasp that such a man as this walked upon the earth. Palm fronds for shade, basil, peppers, early tomatoes here. Strawberries under chicken wire to frustrate deer. In the garden, motes and mites, all waxes and wanes, in shadows leafy, deep sea ocularity. The future drags and drifts and lifts traces of argon, carbon dioxide, and water, sun's majestic past and impending life. You cannot hope to wake anyone who isn't fully asleep, he said. You cannot wake those who are pretending sleep.
Are we comparing Gandhi to some Catholic priest? Is there a pedophilia in that poem?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because Gandhi for many years towards the end of his life slept beside naked girls who once they turned a certain age, he got rid of them and got newer, younger naked girls to sleep beside. The whole idea being and he created a Sanskrit term for this, brahmacharya, which is in the face of temptation, the elimination of all desire. And the notion was that you put yourself with so much temptation and yet did not have, you know, you kept yourself pure, and this is the Hindu notion of storing up, the male storing up one's semen, which increased one's spirituality and one's being closer to God. What happened was one of the girls talked after his death, and among the people who were close to him and they knew what was going on were very disturbed by this activity. And then, you know, there's no, other than the one girl that talked about what went on, Manu and Abha, who were also his relatives. So it's not just pedophilia, it's incest as well. Were upon his death, they were immediately escorted away and hidden from anyone talking about Gandhi's life and all of that. So it's one of those things where a beloved figure, obviously Gandhi's incredible ideas of nonviolence and a very important man and thinker and philosopher, had flaws, right. Deep problems. And so that was the problem, that I didn't know any of this. A lot of people do know this, I don't think it's common knowledge. I think it's people who know a lot about Gandhi know this. And, there are people who try to scoot it under the rug still or deny it or whatever, but
There it was. Yeah. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
I love doing it.
Good luck with your new book, Peace.
Okay.
We look forward to that coming out.
Good.
And maybe you'll come on up to the Word Temple Poetry Series and read there sometime.
I would love to do that. That would be fun.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Thank you.
You've been listening to Gillian Connolly reading from her new book, Peace, coming out from Omnidon. Earlier in the program, when we were having a little conversation, she mentioned that her father ran a radio station in Texas when she was a child, and one of the performers she remembers coming through was Joe Tex and the song Skinny Legs and All. So, Gillian, this is for you.
Ahead of that woman like she don't belong to you. Just cause her got them little skinny legs, you know that ain't no way to do. You didn't act like that when you had it home behind closed doors. All right. Now you act like you're ashamed of the woman. Don't even want nobody to know she's yours. But that's all right. You just walk on, baby. Don't you worry about a doggone thing at all. Because there's some man somewhere who'll take you, baby, skinny legs and all. That's right. Keep on walking, baby. show you what I'm talking about. Listen to this. Now, who'll take the woman with the skinny legs? Stand right there, baby. I'm going to give you away in a minute. Come on, somebody please take the lady with the skinny legs.
I don't know.
Now, y'all know the lady with skinny legs got to have somebody, too, now.
My own.
Will somebody please take the lady with the skinny legs, please?
Hey, Joe.
Yeah, Bobby.
How would you take it?
Shut up, fool. I don't want no woman with no skinny legs. Look here. I thought about giving this woman a Clive, but no. See, I know the kind of women Clive like. Little Leroy will take her. Say, Leroy, you got it. You want to act like that man ain't yours? Just because he's walking with you with them raggedy clothes. Man just forgot to get his suit out the cleaners, that's all. All right. All right. You act like that man don't belong to you. Go on over there and kiss him and hold his hand. Say, you ain't going to do what? That's all right. You just walk on, mister. Don't you worry about a doggone thing at all. Because there's some woman somewhere who'll take you, Mr. Raggedy Clothes and all. Yes, there is. Let's keep on going.
Okay, so we'll call that our musical interlude of the night. We have a little bit of time left, so I'm going to play just a brief section of a show that I aired back in August of 2011. This is Paul Hoover reading from his book, Sonnet 56. Welcome, Paul.
Oh, it's good to be here.
It's nice to see another book out from you, and this one is Sonnet 56, and this book has 56 variations of William Shakespeare's Sonnet 56 that you wrote. Well, you have some traditional forms in the book, like the villanelle, but many that are not traditional, like noun plus seven, larf. Why don't you read the original Shakespeare sonnet and then pick a handful of poems that you would like to read and explain what some of them are, like flarf or whichever ones you want to read?
Sure. Okay, well, here's the original Shakespeare sonnet. And each of these poems has a title, usually the form that it's in. This is called simply Shakespeare. Sweet love, renew thy force. Be it not said thy edge should blunter be than appetite, which but today by feeding is allayed, tomorrow sharpened in his former might. So love be thou, although today thou fill thy hungry eyes, e'en till they wink with fullness. Tomorrow see again, and do not kill the spirit of love with a perpetual dullness. Let this sad interim like the ocean's be, which parts the shore, where two contracted new come daily to the banks, that when they see return of love, more blessed may be the view. As call it winter, which being full of care, makes summer's welcome thrice more wished, more rare. Let me give you an example of noun plus seven.
Okay.
Noun plus seven comes from the French group Oulipo. I'll explain that some other day, probably. But they come up with writing games.
Right.
Okay.
And for our listeners, that's Oulipo.
That's correct.
They can look that up. Yeah.
Yes. And the idea is very simple. You take a dictionary, any dictionary, and you replace the original nouns, all the nouns of the poem with the seventh after in any dictionary you have.
Mm-hmm.
So here we go. Sweet love game, renew thy forecaster. Be it not said thy editor should blunter be than Applejack, which but today by feeling is allayed, tonality sharpened in his former mildew. So love game, be thou, although today thou fill thy hungry eyebright, e'en till they wink with foolery. Tomorrow see again, and do not kill the spirochete of love with a perpetual dumbbell. Let this sad interleaf like the ocotillo be, which parts the shortcake, where two contracted new come daily to the banker, that when they see revelation of love game, more blessed may be the vigilante. As call it winter melon, which being full of carfare, makes sumpweeds well curb thrice more wished, more rare. And I have another example that I often read right after that one, which is haikuization.
Mm-hmm.
You make a haiku of the sonnet 56. And you could haikuize any other work of literature, a great novel, for example.
War and Peace.
War and Peace, yeah. I put that on my blog, and someone gave me a haiku of War and Peace. So here's the haikuization. Love, renew thy force. Thy edge should blunter be than tomorrow sharpened.
I remember that you read one called Course Description at the Word Temple Poetry Series.
Yes, Course Description is in prose. And of course, anyone who's taught, usually at the college level, has written course descriptions repeatedly. So I made one. Here is Course Description. Shakespeare, non-dramatic verse, English 619. In this senior seminar emphasizing Shakespeare's lyric production, we'll focus exclusively and intensively on Sonnet 56, which perfectly displays the great poet's vulnerability and craft. Using a variety of critical approaches from the Marxist and feminist to deconstruction, gender studies, and queer theory, we will examine the poem's palimpsestic structures of meaning. Was Shakespeare intimate with the reckless Lord Southampton who funded construction of the Globe Theater? When love's summer comes to winter, what season of love renews it? Course requirements include a 56-page seminar paper employing at least two of the above critical schemes. Formalist readings are not allowed. All papers and class discussions must relate to the historic collapse of dominant systems of sense-making in the post-Soviet period. Prerequisites, English Comp 1 and 2, or concurrent enrollment in those classes.
What a course.
Yeah, wow. Well, you realize how, you know, kind of puffed up a lot of course descriptions are.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. They are sales pitches.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to a traditional form for just a minute. Would you read the villanelle?
Villanelle. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. Today, by eating, we have dulled it a bit. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. Hunger makes your kiss sharper than your bite. I've known the best and worst of it. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. The hearts of lovers are always in the right. Though pleasure is touched with emptiness, our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. For a day of love, we starve a thousand nights. Only true lovers get their fill of it. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. No dullness now, only things that shine. Rivers drown in oceans, lovers in each other. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right. The saddest lover knows the taste of life, weight of darkness, sighs of night. Love's sweet edge is sharpened by appetite. Our hungry eyes see no wrong or right.
And that's pretty much a wrap for tonight's program. I want to thank Gillian Connolly and Paul Hoover. Be sure to go to wordtemple.com to check out the next live reading at the Word Temple Poetry Series on Saturday, September 21st at 7 p.m. Poets will be Philip Terman, Iris Jamal Dunkel, and Dave Cedar. Word Temple takes place at the Sebastopol Center for the Arts, 282 South High Street in Sebastopol. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any questions or comments, please contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.